and welcome back to CoronaCast.
Hi.
I'm Hannah.
And I'm Tilly.
And just for any new listeners to the show, I'm a GP in South London, and Tilly is my daughter and she's an actor. And together we've been putting out this podcast for a few weeks now about all things to do with coronavirus, health tips, interviews with experts, and also we try to look at the positive side and positive things that are coming out of this very difficult time.
Yeah, and what we can do to carry on.
Yes. So in this episode, we have a really good friend of mine and former colleague, Kelly Amanashoa, and she's an A&E doctor, and she's got a really interesting story to tell. She works in A&E, obviously. She's had coronavirus. She's doing volunteering, and also she's got a really interesting opinion about the black and minority ethnic population being more severely affected by coronavirus, and we discussed that with her too.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to you guys hearing that.
Yeah, it's a lovely interview. Just first of all, my disclaimer, I'm a GP, I'm not a public health or infectious diseases expert. Opinions expressed are my own and not on behalf of an organisation.
Cool.
Now, Tilly, you had something you wanted to tell us about, didn't you?
Yes. So my amazing friend, Ianthi, who actually featured in our mental health episode, she has a theatre company called Five-A-Side Theatre, and they're doing this amazing project called Quarantine Creations. So every weekday morning, they invite you to take 5 minutes out of your day to do a creative activity for that day. So they'll suggest it at 10 a.m. in the morning every weekday, and you can take part in it.
What kind of things do they suggest?
So one that I did was springtime. So they said, play a song that reminds you of spring and free draw to it for 5 minutes. But I did two songs because my song was shorter than 5 minutes and I wanted to do it more. They'll do things like recreate your favourite painting, shuffle a song on your playlist and dance around the room. It can be so many different things, but they just want you to take 5 minutes to do something, to be present in the moment and hopefully lift your mood. And I think it's a really amazing project. So you can go and check that out on their Instagram account called at Five-A-Side Theatre.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. And we'll put a link in the podcast blurb. So next, I think you had a question, Tilly.
Yep. So this is another question from Melanie in Bristol, who asks, should you take zinc? Does that help with your immune system?
I believe that zinc does help to boost the immune system, yes. Evidence around impact on vitamins and on the immune system isn't that readily available, but generally, vitamins are thought to be good for you as long as you don't take too many of them. So don't just think, oh, I'll just take loads of these vitamins because they're going to prevent me getting coronavirus by boosting my immune system, because they can actually be detrimental if you take too many of them. Too much vitamin D can cause high calcium. Too much vitamin C can cause kidney stones. So you do need to be really careful. You should only take the recommended doses. But I do think that topping up your vitamin D, your vitamin C and your zinc can be beneficial for your immunity in general.
Yeah, and make you feel a bit better, I'd say.
Yeah. Now, on to our interview with Kelly. So this is Kelly Amanashoa. She's an A&E doctor, and I'm proud to introduce our listeners to her. So today, I'm delighted to welcome my friend and former colleague, Kelly Amanashoa, to the show. She worked in A&E as a doctor, and she's also been doing some volunteering since the outbreak started, and we just really wanted to hear her story. So hi Kelly, welcome to the show.
Hello, thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. So what's it like working in A&E at the moment, first of all?
Obviously, as it has been for everyone, quite a strange time in A&E, and I feel like we've actually been working up to this for quite a few months now. So probably started thinking about it really in January when case numbers started going up in China, and thinking about how it's going to affect our population and how we're going to plan for it. So there was a lot of talk and planning before it happened. And then people started getting really sick, coming in through our resuscitation department, very unwell, and actually the numbers of those sorts of patients that we're seeing has gone down, thankfully, at the moment.
Oh, that's good. And good to hear.
Yeah, really good. Yeah. So from an admissions point of view, we're actually seeing far fewer patients than we would normally see in A&E, which in some ways itself is also a worry. So we don't want people to be staying away with serious conditions that they would have previously come to A&E with, because they're worried about overloading the system or picking up COVID itself and getting more unwell and having, or, you know, worst case scenarios, people dying at home with things that they should have come to A&E with.
Yeah, we touched on that in the last episode. And yeah, there's research coming through, isn't there, showing that, for example, paediatric mortality has increased since coronavirus started, just because of what you're saying, people staying away from A&E, worried about catching it and staying at home until their kids are really, really ill.
Yeah. And actually, the way we've set up the department and have done for the last few months now since it all started is the department's completely separated into green and red. And if you don't have any of the classical COVID symptoms, you go into that green department and in theory shouldn't be in contact with any other patient who has COVID. Obviously, that's not a foolproof system, but we're doing everything we can to separate the two patient groups and minimise that risk. And we really want people to feel confident to still come to A&E with things that they would have come to A&E with previously.
Great. That's a really great message to be giving our listeners. So yeah, thank you. So you say that numbers are now tailing off of the COVID patients. So hopefully the social distancing has worked.
Yeah, I think we're definitely seeing the benefits and the positive outcomes of social distancing. You know, at the front line in A&E, we obviously just see people as they first come in. And a few weeks ago, we were seeing the effects of not having the social distancing and people becoming very unwell in large numbers coming through the recess department, which is where all the sickest patients come through. And now we're 2 or 3 weeks post social distancing coming in, and we're definitely seeing the benefits. The numbers are right down. See, we are differently impacted to intensive care, and they still have a high patient load because once people are in hospital, they tend to stay for quite some weeks. But definitely from an admissions point of view, with the numbers of really unwell people with COVID have gone down, and I think that's definitely due to social distancing. People should applaud themselves for doing that well.
Yeah, well done for staying at home.
Yeah, good work, everyone.
And I just was wondering what your thoughts are about the impact on doctors' mental health. There's been quite a lot about that in the press. How is that looking from your point of view? Do you think that is going to be an issue in the coming sort of months and even years?
Yeah, so a lot of healthcare professionals have been brought in from different departments, aren't used to working in A&E or intensive care, are seeing things they probably haven't seen before, really unwell patients. And then on top of that, normally we'd be able to speak to families face to face and have those debriefs with people, and we're not able to do that at the moment. So I think there's going to be a lot of negative repercussions on people's mental health, probably an element of sort of post-traumatic stress type symptoms, and we're definitely going to have to plan for that.
Yeah, the volume of unwell patients and in these really difficult, quite bizarre circumstances.
Yeah, and the demographic of the patients, a lot of patients who've been really unwell have been relatively young, middle-aged people, you know, people who have who prior to this were living completely independent lives. And any patient death hits you hard, but it's one thing when you have someone in their 80s who's lived a long life and, you know, has a condition that's managed well and then passed away, compared to someone becoming very unwell very quickly in their 50s who still has a young family. And just the demographic of the patient, I think. And of course, people, we're also losing our own healthcare workers, so we're going to have the repercussions of people coping with that.
Yeah, it's really, really tragic, isn't it? And it's making everybody have to sort of confront their own mortality a lot more
absolutely
than we've ever had to think about before. You know, we've been so lucky, our generation and of surrounding generations, in that, really. And like you said, coming on to our tragically, our colleagues, doctors, nurses and other healthcare professionals who've died of coronavirus, it does seem to infect healthcare workers disproportionately to the rest of the population, doesn't it? Kind of understandably, I guess.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot of talk about the fact that the sort of viral load that you come into contact with has some implication to how sick you get. And obviously, as a healthcare worker, you're not just passing someone who's coughed near you once a day. You're getting a high viral load exposure every time you look after patients with it. So unfortunately has inevitably affected healthcare workers disproportionately to the rest of the population.
Yeah, yeah, of course. And, you know, that's why access to PPE is so important, isn't it?
Yeah.
Have you had any problems absolutely. With that, or has it been pretty good?
I think there's been a bit of, I think, lack of clarity in the press around PPE, because there's two issues. There's one, having access to the actual PPE that Public Health England suggests we use, which personally I haven't seen any problem with. But the second issue, I think, is people feeling that Public Health England's guidelines don't go far enough. And I think in the press, sometimes those two issues get confused, because you see a picture of someone, say on Twitter or something, and they'll say, oh, my relative is a nurse in A&E and all they have is this, and they're wearing a surgical mask and a normal apron and gloves, when actually, if you're not doing a invasive procedure, that is PHE England's guidelines on what you should be wearing.
Yeah, so that is according to the guidelines what they should have. Yeah,
absolutely. And their message is really that they think that's enough, which I think there is some weight to that argument, but I think the two issues often get conflated. At the same time that we're saying to the public that if you wear a mask, it's not going to stop you getting it stops you spreading it, those are the same masks that most staff in hospitals are using. So
yeah.
It feels as if the PPE guidelines for a lot of frontline staff aren't there to stop us getting it. It's more part of the general measures to reduce spread.
Yeah, I feel very strongly that everybody should, in healthcare, you know, working in a hospital or healthcare environment, should have the, you know, filtration marks, the FFP2 or FFP3 N95 masks, because arguably a sneeze or a cough is an airborne procedure in a way.
I feel similarly, and I think actually when you look at, I mean, from our own NE department, I'd say just anecdotally, like half of the people I work with have had it confirmed. So, I mean, it's clearly not, and we've all been using Public Health England PPE the whole time and have had good access to it. So I think it's clearly not preventing the spread of COVID to healthcare professionals.
No, not at all. And then that brings me on to another subject that I was really keen to get your view on, which is about how the virus really seems to be affecting Black and minority ethnic people a lot more than white people in this country, and what the reason for that might be. I've read quite a bit about it, and there's lots of kind of different opinions and possible theories, and what's your take on that?
I find it really heartbreaking, actually. I think probably it's multifactorial. Mm-hmm. I think partly it's reflecting underlying differences in income, in housing levels. It just, I think it reflects a lot that Black and minority ethnic groups are treated less well in this country and have poorer qualities of life because of access to everything, because of lots of institutionalized problems that we have with racism. There must be more to it than that, because it's reflected even in our healthcare workers. So I think almost 100% of the doctors who've died have been Black and minority ethnic groups, and I think it's about 70% of the nursing staff at the moment. You know, there's talk about any biological differences. So there's talk about the ACE inhibitor receptors and things. Minority groups more likely to have some of these comorbidities. Whether there's an element of, in a system where you are often the minority, not feeling able to speak up about things, so whether more likely to work without the right PPE and or less likely to make a fuss if you don't have access to the right PPE.
That's a good point.
I think there's lots to it, but I definitely think it's something that warrants a big investigation after all of this, and really to address it so that this doesn't happen again.
And even during, you know, we need to start getting on top of this now. And it's really
because we don't know how long it will go on for.
And
absolutely,
I think the social sort of and cultural differences, because I felt this might be a bit of a controversial point, but I felt quite angry when I kind of read and heard a few things with people saying, oh, well, you know, they live like families all close together, all like living, you know, lots of generations all together, living in the same room. And yes, there is overcrowded housing among Black and minority ethnic groups, alarmingly much greater overcrowding than with white families. But I don't think we can just use that to explain away the issue. I think like there needs to be some proper rigorous scientific research.
But why is it that our black and minority ethnic groups are more likely to be poor, are more likely to be living in crowded accommodation?
Absolutely. All of it needs to be looked into and investigated.
Yeah, as a sort of black doctor, I've been in tears over it some nights. Just, it makes you feel like actually minority lives are worthless.
Yeah, I'm sure.
There's less of a fuss. And you think when 40% of the NHS healthcare staff come from these groups, and then actually, you know, we clap every week for them, but we don't do anything to investigate why they're dying more.
Yeah, we need to help them.
Yeah, like even if, like, because you were saying, Mum, that it made you angry hearing that kind of reason of, like, they were living in more in close proximity. But it is a good point that even if that is the case, like, you can't just say that and that's the explanation. Like, investigate it. Why is that happening?
And what are we going to do about it? What action are we going to take?
Yeah.
So much of the way that we run this country is set up to maintain the status quo. And I think actually we need huge overhauls looking at, you know, childhood education, access to childcare, supporting children. So many children in this country grow up below the poverty line. It's unacceptable. And that disproportionately, again, affects black and minority ethnic children. So I think there's just a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah,
starting
loads.
From day dot.
And if in some way this crisis, pandemic, out of that comes some headway into, you know, improving this and losing these inequalities that we see everywhere all the time, then at least that's something positive that will have come out of it, I guess.
Yeah, I really hope so. I mean, I know there's been some MPs have written a letter. Notably, it's mainly the black and minority MPs who write these letters, but
of course,
have written a letter calling for an investigation into this. So we can but hope and campaign as we do to hopefully see a difference.
We must keep on campaigning.
Yeah.
Sending these petitions to our MPs and writing to our local MPs and things like that.
I can't remember which trust it was actually. One trust has taken it upon themselves to address the issue and has written to all their minority ethnic staff and said that they acknowledge that there's an issue and they will prioritise them for testing and basically treat them as an at-risk group. So, you know, make sure they have the right PPE and, which, you know, it shouldn't be on individual trusts to make calls like that. But I don't think you would have seen that even 5 years ago. So, yeah, I think people are recognising that it's an issue more and more.
That's really good, and hopefully other trusts will follow that example.
I want to remember what trust it is now because I feel like they deserve the
we can put it in the link in the
okay,
description link.
Yeah, we will do. Kelly, also, you have had coronavirus yourself, haven't you?
Yes, I have. A testament to our PPE.
yeah. So how was it?
To be honest, I feel pretty lucky that I wasn't very unwell with it. I had a cough one day. I'd been to work the day before, and it was a kind of cough that prior to this I would have still gone to work with and just thought it was a common cold, which again I think shows a lot about like the sort of presenteeism of healthcare workers, that often I think we go to work and just muddle through and carry on when we maybe shouldn't be. But with this, obviously I didn't go in, and then our St George's Hospital is where I work, and actually they've been testing staff for quite a while with symptoms, which is good. So I had a test a couple of days later and it came back positive. And to be honest, at first I was really surprised it was positive because I didn't feel that unwell. I had a cough and I had a bit of shortness of breath, but nothing too bad. But once the test came back positive, I then started having the fevers. So I had fevers for maybe 5 days and then that was the end of it. And I was actually back to work after 8 days, which again is another sort of area of contention because the WHO recommends 14 days from when you've tested positive, whereas Public Health England are saying 7.
Yeah.
And there's been quite a bit of debate about that because a lot of studies are showing you can still be shedding the virus 14 days and even longer.
Yeah, even 26 days, I think. Like, I think the median is sort of 7 or 8 days. But yeah, the range is much longer than that. And I've come across quite a few patients and friends and people I know who have had, the course of the virus has been a lot longer. I don't know if you've seen that. I assume you have. People who have had the symptoms kind of coming and going for up to 4 weeks, or even I saw a patient who'd had the symptoms coming and going for 8 weeks. Have you seen that?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what's sort of scary and also interesting about this virus. It seems to have such a range of symptoms with different people, even within families. And absolutely seeing people coming in who've had symptoms for 6 weeks, and, you know, making sure they haven't got any complications that we're missing. But sometimes actually there aren't any. We don't find anything apart from the fact that they have had COVID-19. It just takes such a long recovery. And also I think people get very deconditioned from it. So then their exercise tolerance is much lower and they feel very short of breath on quite minimal exercise.
Yeah, and get really lethargic.
And that's quite scary.
Yeah, you hear about people going back to work and they just can't continue because they just feel like lacking in energy.
Yeah, and actually that's something I really felt was during the week that I was unwell. I was so lethargic. I was sleeping for 14-16 hours a night sometimes.
Gosh.
And not waking up at all, just like sleeping all the way through. And the lethargy seems to be really extreme.
Oh well, I'm really glad you're feeling better now.
Yeah, can I just ask, like, when you got tested positive, did you feel scared at any point?
It was a bit surreal in the moment. I wasn't initially scared, and then my mum found out and just burst into tears.
Aww.
And I think that's when I first like felt a bit scared, because there's a lot of sort of rhetoric around the fact that if you're young you'll be fine, which mostly is true, but there are cases of young
where
people
you're not,
you know, yeah, where you're not. And I think, like you said, Hannah, earlier, I think all of us are just confronting our mortalities in a way that we've never really had to before. So yeah, when my mum cried I was a bit scared.
Yeah, because I was just wondering, because I think if I got tested positive, I think I would feel a bit on edge about, well, you would, but a bit scared. So I was
absolutely.
I think being ill itself can give you mood problems.
Yes, like, I definitely find that.
You know, low mood and anxiety. I think that can happen anyway, but I have seen with patients particular anxiety when I'm talking to them about their coronavirus symptoms. You know, it's a really scary thing.
But I feel like that's just because there's so much on the news and stuff. Like, it's all you're hearing about. COVID is the reason that our lives have changed so much. So I think, you know, you would feel that heightened anxiety if you've got the virus that's the reason for all of this.
Yeah, you're suddenly a statistic.
Yeah.
Even in A&E, we do see a lot of anxiety around COVID, or patients come in with symptoms which are probably classic COVID. And we're not at the moment testing anyone unless they get admitted to hospital. A lot of people come in mainly because they're just so scared that it's going to get worse, or, you know, that they're worried that they're going to die. And it's a lot of it is reassurance and educating people to know when to come back and that they can come back and what symptoms to worry about. But it's understandably very scary for people.
Yeah, it really is. I just wanted to move on to a more positive side of things, which is your volunteering. Can you tell us about that? It's amazing, Kelly. I can't believe you're working in A&E full time and you've had the virus and you're volunteering.
Yeah.
Incredible woman.
Thank you so much.
No, not at all. I mean, like I say, at the moment A&E actually is quieter than it's ever been. So it's a funny time, because I feel like we're getting more attention and support than ever before, but actually we're less busy at the moment than we've ever been before, but the support is very much appreciated. So we've got a great, I live in Croydon North, and we have a great MP, Steve Reed, and it's his staff are coordinating the volunteering in Croydon. So you sign up through the website, and then it's such a positive email that I get every day, because there's a woman called Mary who emails each day with the list of jobs that need doing, and normally within an hour she'll email back and say, thanks everyone, but the jobs have been filled for today. So it's just so nice to know that, like, the whole town is so on it that within an hour every request is filled.
That's amazing.
It's really, really positive. Yeah. And my main volunteering at the moment is there's a woman who lives near me who's self-shielding, because she's in the at-risk group for 12 weeks. So my job is to walk her Sharpay, which I don't feel like it's a very taxing job.
I would love that.
That is so cute.
Yes, you would love it. She's gorgeous.
What's her name?
Her name is Boo Bear.
Boo Bear.
She's absolutely gorgeous. So it really doesn't feel like work at all.
No,
we just go for nice long walks around Croydon.
Perfect antidote to work, in fact, I imagine.
Yeah, exactly. It really is. It's actually so good for your mental health. Like, anytime I'm feeling stressed, an hour later I'll be feeling much better after seeing her.
Oh, great.
No, so it's lovely.
And what else are you doing to unwind and relax?
So I really enjoy exercise and have done for a while now, particularly weight training, which is difficult with all the gyms being closed. But my trainer is still running her programs, so she sort of made home workouts that you can use, like whatever you can find around the house as weights
and
resistance bands and things. So yeah, she's great. La Bonita PT, if anyone's looking in the Penge area. So I've been doing her workouts every day, and my yoga teacher is, you know, it's I guess another sort of silver light, not silver lining, to not to undermine all the awful things that have happened because of this, but no, I think in times of stress things do come out of it, things move forward in a way that they wouldn't in normal times. And so all these sort of Zoom meetings and recognizing what you can do from home and what you can do at distance, my yoga teacher started doing Zoom classes, so I'm still doing that with her each week, reading and trying to keep my sort of usual habits as much as I can.
Yeah, that's really important, isn't it? You really need to look after yourself and your well-being, both physical and mental, when you're going through this kind of difficult, challenging time.
What are you guys been up to?
Ah, well, we've been doing quite a lot of exercise. Tilly is doing amazing workouts every morning with her friends. They all Zoom and do the workout at the same time.
Because we were all saying we were trying to do exercise, but then we weren't actually doing it. So we were like, hey, no, we'll make a date and like FaceTime in the morning and do it together, so that, you know, you feel bad if you don't do it with them. So you have to do it. But I actually feel much better for it. Yeah,
absolutely. It's really good.
And we're going to plant some vegetables in our garden as well.
Oh, lovely.
The soil's just arrived and some seeds.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, so that's nice. Going to be fun. Yeah.
I parted some sunflowers this week, actually, and they started sprouting already.
Oh,
it's so
nice.
Sunny at the moment.
Wow, yeah, it's perfect weather, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's lovely weather.
Brilliant. Well, it's been so nice talking to you, Kelly. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Lovely to talk to you.
Yeah, and thank you so much for all your wonderful work.
Yeah, it's been so informative.
Ditto with you guys, and I think this is such an important platform to sort of try and get some more information out there and to try and keep a balanced picture. I think it's easy to sort of go down a bit of a negative spiral with some of the media, and I feel like you guys are doing something really positive with it.
Thank you. And so main message from today is go and see Kelly in A&E if you're sick.
Yeah.
If you need us, come to see us. That's what we're here for, and we're still here for.
Yeah, brilliant. Thank you, Kelly.
No worries.
Bye. Thank you so much to Kelly for that interview. It's really inspiring, I think.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed that interview. And I also found it so interesting to hear about all those things. I feel like it motivated me to do more in the community, but also hearing about the Black and ethnic minority groups who are being so badly affected. And that was, I found that interesting, but also very frustrating that that is something that we're facing. And I think it's really important we raise awareness about that, because it's not fair.
Yeah, it shouldn't be like that. It's huge numbers of people affected in such a negative way.
Yeah.
And we can all do something about it, not just the government, but every individual can help with campaigning, but also just in general with attitude, and raising awareness about this is key.
Yeah, we have the explanation now. It's time to do something about it.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, also really encouraging to people to volunteer.
Yeah.
Like he said.
Yeah. Kelly, the A&E doctor, can do it. I think we all can.
Definitely.
So thank you so, so, so much to Kelly for that. It was amazing.
Yeah. Thank you, Kelly. And now finally onto our positive news. So I just wanted to start by saying thank you to a very old friend, Jane Ramsell, who lives in East London, but we both grew up in Bristol, and that's how I knew her. And she got in touch after the last episode with quite a few points, actually, brilliant points. So one was about our Zoom chat and how I was saying that I find Zoom quite difficult. She was saying you don't have to look at your face. There is an option to click on, which means you don't have to have your own face on the screen. So that's one thing that will help. Another one was that you can have side rooms. So she does choir rehearsals where the different voice groups go into like Zoom side chats. So you can do that if you need to. Another thing is that she's tried out the Birdsong app and she's enjoying that. Another thing is that, like I was saying, she's in a choir and she's doing the Gareth Malone choir, which I don't think we've mentioned before.
No.
But it has been quite interesting to me, although I haven't tried it. But it sounds brilliant. And new people apparently are enjoying all the time. It's very easy. The pieces are in four-part harmony. You can get sheet music. You go off, learn the music, and then record a video of yourself singing your part. And then they're stitching everybody together, everybody's videos.
Wow, that's amazing.
It's brilliant.
I love that.
Yeah, and there are tutorials on YouTube to teach you. So, and there are celebrity guests. It sounds really good. And then finally, the most inspiring thing is that Jane has joined this massive group of people making scrubs for healthcare workers. It was started by a 70-year-old who didn't even know what scrubs were at the end of March.
His daughter
has helped him to set this up. They had 1,000 people sign up in the first 3 days, and there are now 2,900 people all making scrubs. They're going to have 11,000 sets of scrubs. That's 22,000 items, because there's tops and bottoms.
Wow.
And it's all from fundraised money. And they're going to go to the local area in Hampshire and also the neighbouring borough in East London. There's a Facebook group for the project, which we will post. And thank you for telling us about that, Jane. Those kind of projects are just incredible. So much going on. People are really coming together, and it's amazing.
Yeah, I love hearing stuff like that. I think that is incredible work.
Thanks, Jane.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening.
Yeah, and thank you for the feedback. It was really appreciated. And my positive news is that after this recording, we are going to dye my hair pink. I've been toying with the idea. I'm so bored in quarantine, and I'm just like, you know what? Now's the time. If it looks bad, I'm not seeing anyone. Like, I just decided to have a hair change to spruce things up a bit in life.
Yeah, so that's our next little project.
Yeah, we'll let you know how it goes on social media.
Yeah, we might even post some pictures if it's successful.
Yeah, only if it's successful.
Not that I've ever helped dyeing someone's hair pink, so
it's the first time for everything.
Cool, so we'll let you know how that goes.
Yeah.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much, as always. You can find us on social media, on Twitter and Instagram, with @thecoronacast.
Or you can email us questions@coronacast.co.uk.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
This podcast is produced by Pod and Chips for all your podcast needs.